This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our guest today is Jonathan Mooney. He says when he was a kid, he was one of those kids. He rode the short bus. Jonathan Mooney was in special ed. At the end of third grade, he was labeled learning disabled with attention problems. He says he dropped out of school for a while in the sixth grade and had a plan for suicide by the time he was 12. But things have turned out well for Mooney. He graduated from Brown with honors in English and is now the president of a not-for-profit mentoring and advocacy organization for students with learning disabilities called Project Eye to Eye. He lives in New York City with his wife, Rebecca. A few years back, Jonathan Mooney went out to Los Angeles, where he grew up, and he picked up an old special ed school bus. He was going to take some time and travel around the country talking with other people who had ridden the short bus. Mooney, who had been told he wouldn't amount to much, wanted to see, in his words, the lives they had fashioned for themselves. This afternoon, we'll talk with Jonathan Mooney about that trip and what he discovered as a result of taking it. Jonathan Mooney, the author of The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal, is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Jonathan Mooney. He is a recipient of the Truman Fellowship for Graduate Study in the fields of creative writing and disability studies. In addition to being the author of The Short Bus, he is the co-author of Learning Outside the Lines. The Short Bus, the new book published by Henry Holt. 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Jonathan Mooney, it's so good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm very well, Celeste. Thanks for having me on your program.
Sure, my pleasure. You struggled in school from the first, from kindergarten, and you faked reading. How did you do that?
Good question, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, I did fake reading for most of my early education. I, in fact, did not learn to read until I was 12 years old. Even after I had learned to read, so to speak, and I, if you could see me, I'm doing sort of air quotation marks around that, because I still struggle to this day tremendously with the act of reading. I read, my phonetic awareness is in the 12th percentile. Which means that my ability to decode the sounds of language is the equivalent of a seventh grader. I spell at a third grade level, you know. So I made it through school in many respects by faking it until I made it, you know. And I'm kind of a believer in that in some respects. You know, I found my way around the system. I found loopholes in the system. I learned to memorize at a very young age. So a lot of people weren't aware of my difficulty in reading. I also, as I got older, I found the beautiful world of books on tape, a way to get around the act of reading and still engage with knowledge, still engage with literature.
Yeah. So what was life like at Brown for you?
Brown was a revelation. I have to be honest with you, and that may sound like a kind of an untenable paradox. How could somebody not learn to read until they were 12 years old, drop out of school in sixth grade, as you mentioned, grow up in the hallway with the janitor throughout his entire education, which I did? How could Brown be a better place? But it was. It's a real part of my work with young people to help them understand that higher education is a very different animal and phenomena than secondary education, than elementary school and middle school. You know, higher education is better for a lot of young people who are outside the lines. Not easier, now don't get me wrong, but better. You know, it's a place that's driven by your passion for learning. It's a place that's driven by your purpose as a learner. You know, it's a real paradox for young people with ADD that when they're chosen to be somewhere, when they've decided that they want to be there, there's no deficit of attention. When they're building a car engine from scratch or when they're writing poetry, there's no problem with paying attention. So I think higher education is a better place for young people with learning differences.
Yeah, and it's a different community also.
It is. You know, it was a revelation for me. I grew up really disconnected from any community of people with learning differences or physical differences. As you alluded to in your introduction, I grew up in special education. You know, I grew up chilling out with C-Spot Run and the slow reading group, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up very much ashamed of being an individual with a cognitive difference. And I tried to hide that throughout my whole life, you know, throughout high school. I became the kid who was not just normal, but super normal, you know, the athlete, disconnected from any sense of being a part of a community of people with learning differences. But when I got to Brown University, I realized that not only were there people like me there, but there were people who celebrated those differences and didn't hide them. And that was a monumental moment in my life.
Yeah. Tell us the story of how you were diagnosed as being learning disabled. It's at the end of the third grade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and end of the third grade. But I have to point out there for you and your listeners that I had other labels before the label of learning disabled. I had the label of being the stupid kid. I had the label of being the bad kid. And I had the label of being the lazy kid. You know, I like to call stupid, crazy, lazy the LD Holy Trinity, you know, because a lot of people with these cognitive differences, before they get a name for their difference, like dyslexia or like ADD, their sense of self is undermined through the label of stupid, crazy, and lazy. So in some respects, it very much was a step forward for me when I was diagnosed with dyslexia, because I'll be honest, it's better to be dyslexic than stupid, you know, in your own mind. And I had a gifted educator named Mr. R, and I want to be very clear. In my journey, I would not have made it to Brown University, written the books I've written, if it wasn't for teachers who were committed to my education, unequivocally. I had a gifted educator who pulled my mom aside one day, called me into his office, said to my mom and me, "Jonathan, you remind me of my daughter." He made it very personal. "My daughter went to Harvard, and my daughter's dyslexic." And that's a totally different way than the vast majority of the diagnosis conversations. Most of the diagnosis conversations, parents get called into a hushed room. There's a box of tissue next to the parents because the ethic is that this is a tragedy, but not for Mr. R. For Mr. R, this was just a difference.
Yeah. It was tough on your mom. Your mom felt accepting that label, LD, learning disabled, was making a deal with the devil, but she had no idea how to get out of it. So how did your mom cope with the devil before there was Mr. R?
Well, let me clarify, because I think this is a situation that many families find themselves in and many young people find themselves in, and that is we live in a world and specifically school, that's not built to holistically and naturally accommodate learning differences. So the only tool for a family or a young person to modify that system, the only tool that I have at my disposal is the label of learning disabled. Said differently, if I don't call myself learning disabled, if I call myself somebody with a learning difference, and I don't get diagnosed, I don't get books on tape. I don't get accommodations to help me be included within the environment. So that's a real deal with the devil. I mean, it really is. You have to, as a mom, as a dad, as an individual, you have to say, something's wrong with me, therefore you should do something differently in the classroom. Now, my mom dealt with that sort of deal, for lack of a better word. She dealt with it by being very honest with me. And I encourage all parents to do this. Well, my mom said to me very clearly, my mom's kind of a pragmatist in the good old American pragmatist tradition. She said, look, I don't think anything's wrong with you. Your brain functions differently. You have a lot of strengths and gifts. You have some specific weaknesses, but it doesn't mean you have a cognitive defect. But our world isn't built for your mind. So to play the game of school, we have to use this language, and we have to use this language and label. And when we use it, we're just going to wink at each other, and we're going to understand that it's us playing a system that in some respects is broken. It's not you being broken and changing yourself.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jonathan Mooney. He is the president of Project Eye to Eye. He is also the author of The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, someone calling in from Terre Haute this afternoon on line 4. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. I don't know how good my connection is, so I'll just make two quick points and ring off. Was wondering if your guest could speak to the school system. My sense of it is that it's a lot of it is about labeling, as you guys have discussed, and also conformity. I have two children, 12-year-olds, who they wanted to stick in her special ed class because of her speech, and she just completed her third professional show in Chicago on the stage. And another child, 7-year-olds, who they wanted to hold back from kindergarten because she was shy, and she's pulling straight A's in second grade. So the parent has to go to bat for these kids, and we've been blessed with exceptional teachers, but I do feel the system itself has a tendency to label kids, wanting to label them, wanting to stick them on a shelf, something like that, and to conform. You're not conforming. And so I would just say to be mindful of that, and was wondering if the guest could speak on either or both of those two points.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
Well, it's and I commend your caller for being such a tremendous advocate in the lives of his children. And you know, the caller is exactly right. We live in a system, a school system, and frankly, I think it's above and beyond the school system. I think it's something that's epidemic in our culture, where we found a sickness for every single human difference. You know, really. I mean, if you think about where we are in our culture now, we have a label, a pathology, a nebulous neurological diagnosis for every single difference there is, whether it be a different way of speaking, whether it be a different developmental pattern on when you learn to read, whether it be that you don't make eye contact when you talk. We live in a culture that is pathologizing human difference at an alarming and frightening rate. And I think that the caller's experience with his children is an example of that, an example of a system that needs to pathologize difference and label difference as being defective. But I do think it's very important to note and follow up on this that the caller said, which is it's the system, not the people in the system. And that's a really important point. You know, there are so many gifted educators out there who say to me after I talk, I do a lot of public speaking, mm-hmm. They say, look, I don't want to label kids. I don't think of kids as learning disabled or as having deficits and disorders. I just think of them as children and children with differences. But they live in a system that's made it a requirement that we label and pathologize to get those children services. And I think we need to resist that. I think we need to talk honestly about how children are lost in that process and how teachers are lost, disengaged, and demoralized in that process as well.
Yeah. So where do we start to get at the problems, the issues? Where do we start to improve the situation?
Well, I think in two ways. First and foremost, I think we have to understand the sort of great tipping point we're at as a culture with education. And I do mean that we're at a pretty significant fork in the road. On one hand, and one path at that fork, is all the research out there about learning diversity. You know, this is research that's been going on for 20, for 50 years in the disciplines of psychology, in the disciplines of academic education, in the disciplines of neurology, about how individuals process information in multiple different ways. And we learn differently, with or without labels. There's a body of knowledge out there that can be considered a truism. And yet, the other fork in the road is the standardized education that we're pursuing in our public policy. You know, right now in the news, there's pressure, and the President of the United States is encouraging No Child Left Behind to be reauthorized. And that is standardized education. We have to be honest about that. And that is a form of educational policy that goes in the opposite direction of where the research about the brain is. And that is, how do we figure out a way to embrace the different ways of learning? Now, that's a challenge. Don't get me wrong. It's not utopia. It means that we need to reconceive of the ways that we train teachers. We often train teachers in a silo model, meaning we have special ed in one silo, general ed in another silo, gifted ed in another silo. And we need to reject that silo model and integrate the instruction so teachers are prepared to deal with different learning. But I think that that's a fork in the road. Do we accept, as parents, as teachers, as citizens, standardized education, or do we demand that we have research-based education grounded in the reality of cognitive diversity?
Mm. So can you give us an idea or a couple of examples of what Jonathan Mooney School would be like?
Yes.
What that building would look like and what a day would be like for a kid in that building?
Sure. And I got to be honest with you, this isn't Jonathan Mooney's thought experiment. There's a great school in Brooklyn, New York, that is trying to embody and adopt this model that I'll explain for a second. But it's very important that I reference them for their work. It's called the Generational School, and that we use them as a real world model. So this isn't pie in the sky thinking. This is a school that's pursuing it. But the essence of this school and the essence of what they're trying to do, which I agree 100% with, is they're going to isolate individual instruction on core academic skills, right? The basics, reading, writing, math. They're going to isolate the instruction for that in one-on-one tutorials. So an individual is working maybe just an hour a week, but when it's one-on-one, you can be much more effective with your time and your learning. They're going to isolate academic instruction one-on-one. So things can be individualized. Things can be diversified. Things can be tailored to the learning needs of that individual. And then they're going to do the rest of the day immersing the students in project-based learning. Project-based learning is an old progressive idea. It's an old idea that used to be central to John Dewey's school out of the University of Chicago, out of the lab school, in which people learn by doing. They learn by not just having abstract instruction, but by engaging with that knowledge in the form of projects. So I think that school is a phenomenal example of how, if we think outside the box of the industrialized school, our school system is built on a 19th century model, built on a factory model, built for an old antiquated economy. If we think outside of that box, if we open up the idea of what a classroom is, we do one-on-one instruction, tutorial-based, and then we do project-based learning. The Generation School in Brooklyn, New York is doing that model for the exact same cost as standardized industrial schooling.
Mm. And the kids are getting out of the silos then, too.
They're getting out of the silos, exactly right. The teachers are getting out of the silos. And young people are engaged with a sense of purpose. You know, I think it's the biggest thing. I spent a lot of time working with young people, giving presentations. And I remember I went to a small, very rural school last spring in Virginia. And this school district did an innovative thing. They had traditional 8th grade education 2 days a week, and then the entire 8th grade class went to a different building and did essentially choice-based education. They got to choose what classes they were going to take, often exposing them to potential careers. And when I lectured to this group of 8th graders, very small group, mind you, but nonetheless, and I polled them which building they preferred to be in, the traditional 8th grade classroom or the choice-based educational classroom, which was very rigorous, which had things like physics, which had things like engineering, every single 8th grader chose the choice-based environment. Because when young people feel a sense of purpose, school is not drudgery.
Mm. Yeah. As I mentioned in my introduction, you dropped out of school in the 6th grade and had a plan for suicide. by the time you were 12. Now, you graduated from Brown in June of 2000. You were then in elementary and high school in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. So has the situation for kids with learning disabilities improved? You know, a plan for suicide by the time you're 12, that's desperate.
It's desperate, but unfortunately, so that's not uncommon.
Yeah.
To this day. And I thought, and this is back in 2000, when I embarked on a year of traveling the United States to give presentations on the heels of the publication of my first book, Learning Outside the Lines, I thought what is at the underlying of your question, which is I would go out there and be telling antiquated stories. I'd go out and be telling stories about the bad old days, you know, before we had consciousness about learning diversity. And if anything, I realized that was false. But if anything, I realized that in some respects, the stories were getting worse. I tell a story when I lecture, and when I lecture to young people, I tell a story about how I was accused of being lazy and how I don't really believe in laziness. I believe what's underneath laziness is learned helplessness, which is a concept out of the discipline of psychology. And I tell a story about a very famous learned helplessness experiment in which an animal, a monkey, is put into a cage and is shocked on each side of the cage until it realizes there's no safe place and it lays down. And I ask young people all the time, what happens to the monkey in an experiment like that? And without exception, when I speak to young people without adults present, a young man will raise his hand and say the monkey kills himself. That happened yesterday in Oakley, Kansas, when I lectured. I mean, it happened 2 weeks ago in Arkansas. It happened 3 weeks ago in San Francisco, you know, when I lectured. That's happening in schools, cities, communities across the country.
Yeah. Also, when you were going across the country in the short bus, just being in that vehicle, you were subjected to people shouting all kinds of rude things out to you.
Yeah, I was. You know, the short bus is a powerful symbol, you know, and for me, that was really the goal of it. You know, it's a fairly common phenomena, people actually riding the short bus. But more than being an actual physical vehicle, it's a symbol of difference in our culture and the flip side of difference, which is not so positive, of disability or abnormality. You know, it's permeated our culture as a joke to call somebody a short bus rider. It's permeated our culture in which some bands write songs about the short bus. Kanye West, actually, in his first album, had a series of lines about the short bus. You know, it's permeated our culture as a symbol for being less than, as being, in some respects, on the wrong side of what we consider to be normal humanity. And I wanted to really appropriate that symbol, transform that symbol. And I wanted to kind of obliterate that line. Where is the line? What is acceptable, normal humanity? Well, the reality is physical and cognitive differences is the norm. That's the essence of what it means to be human, but we've lost sight of that in our culture that's obsessed with normalcy. Mm.
Let's take another call. A listener in Gibson City. Hi, you're on the air with Jonathan Mooney.
Yes, hello. I'm so glad to hear you speak. I actually have two handicapped adult children now. I have three children, and they all graduated in the late 90s from high school. But our youngest daughter has spina bifida, and she is in a wheelchair right now. But to show the difference of and a son that was diagnosed at 22 with attention deficit disorder, and that's a long story, but I guess Abby, with her physical disabilities, really, we got all the help we needed, really, and she was, I think even now she's got a very healthy attitude about her disability. On the other hand, our son, who we didn't even know, we knew something wasn't right, and even in high school he was tested, and there was holes in his testing, but they couldn't tell us what it was. And fortunately, he was diagnosed at 22 with a lot of what I call bad living skills behind him. And he is now 34 years old and back in college and has found his, you know, what he wants to do with his life. But he lived at home for those 4 years before he phoned that. And it's, you know, it's been a struggle. And I guess my question to you is, has the testing gotten better, do you know? And, you know, I guess, how can we help support other people? I'll hang up and listen to you, and thank you for what you've done.
Okay. Jonathan?
Well, two great questions, and you know, I want to again commend the caller for sharing her personal experience and the experience of her daughter and her son on the air. You know, the experience of her son, unfortunately, is very common. It's very common for young people with ADD and frankly, other invisible disabilities, things that as the caller rightfully pointed out, they're not as apparent, they're hard to see. Many people have skepticism about their legitimacy if you can't see it tangibly. It's a very common phenomenon for young people to have slipped through school, to have known something wasn't quite working, and to have been demoralized by that experience, and to have, as the caller, I think, wonderfully put it, had some bad life skills. I'll say it differently. In my life, struggles with substance abuse, you know, struggles with self-esteem, struggles with relationships, all those things really carry with a young person into their mid-20s. So has things gotten better in terms of the diagnosis? Well, unfortunately, kind of like much in our culture, the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes, because I do think that there is a consciousness that ADD is a legitimate neurological phenomena. There's emerging brain scans that do show the specific area of impairment. So it's not just somebody not trying hard enough. It's not just somebody, you know, not wanting to pay attention. There is a legitimate neurological root to it. But the no part of that is that information has slowly filtered down to the grassroots of people's school experience. It's been a very slow filtering process. And then the other kind of paradoxical no part of why it hasn't gotten all that much better is because we don't have a nuanced understanding of ADD. This is the problem. When we do diagnose ADD, we tend to the young person who's being diagnosed, to just emphasize the problems of ADD. You know, you can't sit still, you can't pay attention. Emphasize the disorder part of the equation. But what we need to emphasize as well, and what I encourage the caller to emphasize to her son, is the pro side of ADD. There's a significant pro side of ADD. A lot of people with ADD are extremely intelligent. You have to be of above average IQ to be diagnosed with ADD. A lot of people with ADD are extremely entrepreneurial. Many of them are extremely lateral thinkers. They think out of that proverbial box. Many of them are great multitaskers. So I encourage people to, A, understand that it's a legitimate neurological phenomenon, B, understand that there's research behind that, let's get it all the way down to our schools and diagnose it. But when we diagnose it, let's tell the whole story. Let's tell the story of the problems, yes, but let's tell the story of the strengths, gifts, and talents that come with it.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jonathan Mooney. He is the author of The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. He's a recipient of the Truman Fellowship for Graduate Study in the fields of creative writing and disability studies. In addition to being the author of The Short Bus, he's the co-author of Learning Outside the Lines. Jonathan Mooney was diagnosed with a learning disability at the end of his third year in school, at the end of the third grade, and he dropped out of school for a while in the sixth grade, and ultimately, though, he's graduated from college, from Brown, with honors in English. He's now the president of a not-for-profit mentoring and advocacy organization for students with learning disabilities called Project I2I. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with questions, comments this afternoon for our guest, Jonathan Mooney, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now, a listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. You know, a cautionary note. I taught psychology until I retired, and I had a young lady come to me and said she had a learning disability, and she needed more time and to take the test. And I complied, and I said, sure, there's special facilities for that set up on a campus. I was teaching at Kansas State. And she she came back later and said, I still need more time. And I said, look, how are you approaching the test? And she said, well, I take one question at a time, and I spend as much time as the questions I can to get it right. And I go, can't seem to finish. And I said, no. I said, try this. Go through and answer all the easy questions first. And then you go through and you start eliminating choices. It was a multiple choice test. She said, eliminating choices. And the next test, she came back and she said, that was the easiest test I ever took. Now, here's a case where she was diagnosed with a learning disability, but all she needed was a little instruction in how to take a test. And I'm not saying that learning disabilities don't exist. I really do think they do. But in a lot of cases, I think, people need to be instructed in how to approach a task. I'll take my reply off the air.
Okay.
I think the caller makes an excellent point, and I think he makes an excellent point in for two reasons. First and foremost, the definition of having a learning disability is not necessarily school failure or the ability to not approach a test correctly. And that's a very important point to make for a couple reasons. It's important for the obvious reason that the caller was making to make sure that young people aren't inappropriately diagnosed when they're just having learning skills problems. But there's a flip side and a backstory to that point, and that is just because somebody does well academically doesn't mean they're not learning disabled. And that's a really important point. A lot of people said, Jonathan, you're at Brown University, you have 4.0 in English literature, which I graduated with. You're not learning disabled, because we've constructed learning disabled as intrinsically linked to school failure, and it's not. You know, I can very much be successful academically, be a finalist for the Rhodes Scholarship, get a 4.0 at Brown University, write two books in BLD. That's a paradox that we could hold. So it is grounded in a neurological difference. And as we get better with testing, the subjective part of the tests, which are measured primarily through IQ and whatnot, and the differentiating between certain skill sets in the IQ test, that's going to go away, and we're going to have concrete brain imaging to show cognitive differences visually, and we won't rely upon that subjectivity. Now, one other thing I want to say in response to that caller, because I also think that he made a very good point, which is often a lot of teachers, professors, whether it be a physics professor, whether it be a first grade teacher, often there are a lot of simple things, to go back to that question of how can we do without labels, a lot of simple things that teachers can do to empower students to not have to use that definition of themselves as LD. Caller made a great example. Help them approach the test differently.
Mm-hmm.
I take it a step further. Let's challenge why there's time testing at all. You know, there's no pedagogical reason for time testing. All there is, the only reason, is for bureaucratic reasons, managing students, et cetera, et cetera. There's no pedagogical reason why how fast somebody knows something should trump how well they know it. So there's a lot of ways that individual teachers, like your caller, can modify the environment in subtle ways to make the use of a label irrelevant.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line 2. And no, that caller's dropped off. Sorry. Maybe they'd like to give us a call back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So let's talk a little bit, before we run out of time, about this trip you took across the country. For you, it was life-changing. Tell us a little bit about how you changed as a result of this trip.
Well, the trip, well, I mean, was first and foremost, was quite an odyssey.
Yeah.
It was about 4 or 5 years in the making. It was 35,000 miles, 47 states, 4 months, one big circle through America, starting in Los Angeles, through the South to Maine, through the Midwest, great state of Illinois, all the way to Seattle and back down Highway 101 home. And it was a journey, and I think that was really what I needed at that time in my life. I wanted to journey into the social experience of people labeled abnormal and disabled, and I wanted to journey into the sort of way that our society constructs normality, which is really the heart of it for me, both intellectually in terms of what the book's about, but also in terms of what the journey was about for me. It was a struggle with a message that I got at a very young age that I wasn't normal. Mm. A response to that message of trying to be normal and deny the things about me that made me different. And then a journey into that concept and into that wound and into that that emotional experience in the short bus, again, around the country. And a realization that the best things about me were those differences. You know, I had started the bus, and I don't want to give away the ending, but what the heck, who cares? I started the bus thinking that I was going to, you know, get rid of the bus at the end of the trip. You know, I was going to drive it 35,000 miles, have a cathartic experience, leave it in front of my school, you know what I mean, and be done with it. But at the end of the book, I couldn't get off the bus. You know, I couldn't get off it because all these beautiful people, a guy named Kent Roberts, who's a performance artist with ADD, came into my life because of the bus. Beautiful little girl named Ashley, deafblind, like the cursor teachers out in sign language, you know. She came into my world because of the bus, not despite the bus, but because of the bus. So I couldn't get off the short bus when it was all said and done. Those things, those experiences, those differences are some of the most beautiful things about being human.
Yeah. I've got a couple of callers who want to talk with you and want to get to them right away, but I also want to ask you just a little bit about Ashley, because when you met Ashley, your first impression was she's abnormal, but that changed. Tell us a little bit about Ashley and your change of mind.
Well, Ashley, as I mentioned, her physical experience is radically different from the so-called typical normal physical experience. She's deafblind. She is disconnected from sight. She's disconnected from hearing. And if you believe a sort of Aristotelian conception of human nature and a conception of human nature that runs through all of Western philosophy, perhaps most epitomized by Descartes, that you think, you process language, therefore you are. Well, what about Ashley? Ashley can't see. She can't hear. How does she engage in the human experience? How does she process language? How does she think? Therefore, she is. And my instinct was she couldn't. Therefore, she was on the other side of that line of what it means to be human. And there's a great realization in the story, for me at least, because this isn't about how Ashley changed. It's about what was wrong with me, to be frank, where I see her working with a teacher, and I see them working through touch sign language, which is a beautiful language, which is a way to communicate with people like Ashley. And I see them laughing, and then I turn to Deborah, who's Ashley's mother, and say, you know, what are they laughing at? You know, why am I not in on the joke? And she goes, no, I'm embarrassed, I can't tell you. I said, no, tell me. She goes, Ashley just cursed you out in sign language, you know? And there, in that moment, you know, it wasn't a girl with problems. It wasn't a girl who couldn't see, couldn't hear. It wasn't a girl divorced from the Western tradition of thought. It was a young woman who likes to curse in sign language. That's a human being in there trying to communicate like any other human being.
Hmm. Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just tuned in just a little while ago. But I saw from what you've been talking about that you may enjoy what I've just opened up a book from my late husband who died 25 years ago and was regarded very highly in the field of what we call back then mental retardation. I don't know what the words are nowadays. And he went to write an alternate definition of mental retardation, where at the start it was all about the pathology and the inability of the individual, and he turned it around into something for the society. And it went, the old definition, the typical definition, went that mental retardation refers to significantly sub-average general intellectual functioning existing concurrently with deficits in adaptive behavior and manifested during the developmental period. And he changed it to, mental retardation refers to a level of functioning which requires from society significantly above-average training procedures and superior assets in adaptive behavior on the part of society manifested throughout the life of both society and the individual. And I thought you'd enjoy that.
Love it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Absolutely love it. And I know that we got another caller on the line, but what I love about it is the understanding that disabilities are inherently social phenomena, not medical phenomena. And that's an important challenge for everyone. People are disabled not intrinsically. They're disabled by our biases, our prejudices, the way we build institutions in our society. It's not broken people. It's a limited view of what is normal.
Actually, we don't have a listener waiting. We have a few minutes left, just a few minutes left. If you'd like to talk with Jonathan Mooney this afternoon, give us a call, 333-9455, 333-WILL. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. You can also call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us a little bit about Project Eye to Eye.
Project Eye to Eye is a nonprofit mentoring organization out of New York City that I started at Brown University about 10 years ago, 1997. I currently serve as the president of the organization, and the organization has a pretty simple, yet I think profound and important mission, and that is we bring into the lives of young people labeled learning disabled or ADHD. We bring into their lives adults, often university students, high school juniors and seniors. We bring them into the lives of younger people with those experiences as mentors. We're not a tutoring program, we're a mentoring program. There's a lot of research out there that one of the core variables in the success of an individual with a learning difference is, do they have a positive image of their future? Do they have hope that things can be okay? In my life, that image was essential. I'll never forget, I dropped out of school. We've talked a lot about that today in sixth grade. And after I left school, I had that plan for suicide. And my mom brought home a videotape, and it was 2020 or Dateline, one of those news magazines. And on that videotape was an interview with a young man, 25 years old. The young man went to Yale Law School, but he couldn't read a word. And his mom read every one of his law books to him. Do you know the hope that image gave me? Mm. Now, sucks to be the guy's mom. You know, like, don't get me wrong, moms out there, right? Y'all got a long road in front of you. But mom wasn't my concern. All that mattered was I saw an image of a positive future. That's what Eye to Eye does. 25 chapters, 16 states. Unfortunately, we don't have a big presence in Illinois, one program in Northwestern. Anybody on the line who's interested in getting involved, finding a mentor, being a mentor, go to jonathanmooney.com. There's great information. It's free of cost. Costs you nothing.
Yeah. That's a great thing to do, by the way, is to read textbooks for folks who can't read them. It is tough work, though. I did it. I volunteered doing that for a little while. It's tough work, but it sure is a good thing to do. And it sure is a hand for somebody who's trying to make their way through school and got to get that material down.
It's a tremendous gift. I can tell you that I would not have been able to pursue my education if it wasn't for accommodations such as that. I encourage parents out there to understand that it is the law that young people with diagnosed learning disabilities, attentional disorders, that they are given accommodations in first grade, in ninth grade, in 12th grade, at the University of Illinois, at University of Chicago, at Harvard, at community colleges. They're given accommodations like books on tape, like time extensions. Those are things that parents and young people should be vocal about. There's things that they should fight for because it makes a transformative difference in somebody's education because it fixes a system that's not right for them. It's not something to fix them, but it's something to lower barriers in the environment.
Mm. Jonathan, we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It was an honor and pleasure to be on your program, Celeste.
Jonathan Mooney has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author, most recently, of The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. The publisher is Henry Holt & Company. You can find Jonathan Mooney on the World Wide Web at jonathanmooney.com.